Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to see you here on this beautiful day. I think it's still beautiful. And good. And thank you for battling our torturous stairs and frustrating elevator. We're sort of a hidden gem, this place. My name is Jay Barksdale. I'm a librarian upstairs in the General Reference Division, and I also maintain the details of the Wertheim Study, which is a room put aside for scholars and writers who have intensive need of our collections on a long-term basis, and Dr. Mills is one such person. The lecture will last about 40 minutes. There'll be a question and answer period. I won't be so crass as to ask for a show of hands, but if we meet outside, I'd be interested in hearing how you heard about this lecture. So, Gene Mills is a native of Boston and is currently an assistant professor at John Jay College, CUNY. Her most recent essay, and get ready, The Writer, the Prince, and the Scholar, Virginia Woolf, D.S. Mirsky, and Jane Ellen Harrison's Russian translation of The Life of the Archpriest Avicum by himself, a revaluation of the radical politics of the Hogarth Press. It'll be published soon in Leonard and Virginia Woolf's Hogarth Press, Networks of Modernism. She's published on Miss Woolf, obviously, and Gertrude Stein. She's recently created a podcast for MoMA to introduce young persons to art objects. She often speaks to young persons and not-so-young persons at her school and at museums. She's a frequent panelist and seminar discussant. And she is currently finishing a book on Virginia Woolf, Jane Ellen Harrison, and the classics, which is the subject of today's talk. So without further ado, please welcome Dr. Gene Mills.
Okay, thanks. I mean, really, I'd like to thank Jay Barksdale, who, as you all just heard, runs the Wertheim Room and the Allen Room, for putting this all together and for giving us the opportunity to share our work in such a really a beautiful room. It's a little intimidating at first. It's such a nice room. I just also want to encourage you all to attend the other lectures in this series. We have Isaac is the curator of the Bird Collection, is going to discuss the library's Woolf holdings. And on Thursday, we have Anne Fernald, who will be talking about, I think, her forthcoming annotated edition of Mrs. Dalloway. Is that right? Anne's here. Let's get started then. I realize that many of you here are familiar with Virginia Woolf, her life and her work, but maybe less so with the life and work of Jane Ellen Harrison. So I'd like to say a few words just to give a little background and context in relation to Woolf as an introduction. As a founder of myth criticism and leading member of the Cambridge Ritualist School, or the Cambridge Group of Classical Anthropologists, as they were called at the time, Jane Harrison is most notably remembered for her three foundational texts on the matrifocal beginnings of the Olympian gods: Prolegomena to the Study of Greek Religion, which was out in 1903, Themis, a study of the social origins of Greek religion, 1912, and Epilegomena to the Study of Greek Religion, 1921. let me see. Each of these books Virginia Woolf either read or was familiar with. Virginia Woolf knew Jane Harrison personally from 1904 until Harrison's death in 1928. Her Ancient Art and Ritual, which came out in 1913, was given to Woolf as a Christmas gift inscribed by the author in 1923. She owned a number of Harrison's books and pamphlets, including Aspects, Aorists, and the Classical Tripos on Russian verbs, and was familiar with Harrison's lectures on religion, psychoanalysis, art, women's rights, and war. In her diaries and letters, Woolf's allusions to Jane Harrison demonstrate a deeply held respect for her scholarship, intellect, and political views. And now I'm going to show you the first slide. Let's see if I do this right. There she is. she's looking a little sad, right? A little what? Stoned. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good icebreaker, actually, right? Looking a little stoned. She's very actually unhappy there. She just has gotten over a little bit of a heartbreak with D.S. McCall, who she found out was going to be marrying someone else, and then also Francis Cornford, with whom she was in love, and he ended up marrying not her, but Francis Darwin. So she's pretty upset after this when this portrait is painted, which is roughly around 1903, I think. No, I'm sorry, it's about 1909 by Augustus John. Anyway, that's her, okay? Virginia Woolf first met Miss Harrison and all the other learned ladies at Newnham in 1904, and one can imagine the private exhilaration of a young, intellectually curious Virginia Stephen encountering the renowned professional woman scholar who had traveled to Greece, published and lectured on Greek art and archaeology, and smoked a pipe on the steps of the Parthenon. It was a relationship that continued off and on for the next 24 years, and their contact increasing, once Woolf added the role of publisher to her own accomplishments with the founding of the Hogarth Press. She writes of Jane in a letter to a friend in 1923, describing her as a gallant old lady, sublime in a lace mantilla, who shared the same superb, high-thinking, agnostic ways that Virginia Woolf shared. Harrison and Woolf were both dismayed by the trend among the younger generation who were converting to Catholicism in droves. When Woolf had assured Harrison that their mutual friend Gwen Raverat was a militant atheist, Harrison responded a little inconsistently, "Thank God." A month before Harrison's death in April 1928, Woolf remembered having tea with Jane, very aged and rather exalted, and afterwards heading home to work and work as hard as I can. When Harrison died, Woolf commented on the funeral arrangements, which followed a typical script from the Protestant liturgy of Jane's northern nonconformist relations and represented a system of thought that neither Woolf nor Harrison shared. Afterwards, Woolf wrote in her diary, "As usual, the obstacle of not believing dulled and bothered me. Who is God, and what the grace of Christ, and what did they mean to Jane?" Virginia Woolf's admiration and respect for Harrison is further supported when, in The Intellectual Status of Women, she uses Jane Harrison as an example of the advance in intellectual power by women in her response to Desmond McCarthy, who argued in The New Statesman that women were intellectually inferior. Woolf also asked Harrison to write her memoir, Reminiscences of a Student's Life, which she published at the Hogarth Press in 1925. And perhaps Woolf's most famous essay, A Room of One's Own, based on two talks she gave to the Arts Society at Newnham and Girton Colleges in October 1928, where she mentions the ghost of Jane Harrison as the great J.H. haunting the grounds of the college, which was intended as a tribute to Harrison, who died in April of that year. Let's just see what else we got here. These slides, this is Virginia Woolf about the age, Virginia Stephen, really, at this point, about the age that she met Jane Harrison at Newnham, so roughly around 1904. And this is Jane Harrison, about the age that she met Virginia Woolf, the young Virginia Stephen. okay. Let's see. There are so many points of contact between Jane Harrison and Virginia Woolf that the book that I've been working on called Goddesses and Ghosts, right, is beginning to mirror the girth of the Bible in the Hawaiian language. There are only 12 letters in Hawaiian. But even with the 26 stalwart English ones at my disposal, it has become necessary to narrow it down. So the main focus of my talk today is to explore Harrison's and Woolf's pacifism, okay, and to read Harrison's essay, Epilogue on War, Peace with Patriotism, alongside Woolf's pacifist polemic, Three Guineas. So here goes. You would think that if you had struggled through a PhD program late in life as a returning lesbian mother, okay, is it okay to say that now? Now that Annette Bening and Julian Moore have portrayed us and the kids are all right? Did y'all see that? Yeah, it was all right. but I think not, actually, especially since in this age of insanity, bullying, hatred, and war, that the kids clearly are not all right. But you would think that because I've made it this far, right, and have had all the benefits of this university education, that I would not have to look up a word like opposite. Forget about matriarchy and patriarchy and trying to nail down the abstractions and realities of those two words. What does it mean to be opposite, and are they? So I went looking for some definitions because you can find them all over the place these days, and in some of the most unlikely places, like under rocks, and in fox dens in the woods and in hen houses. They're even in the air, but not so high up on the atmosphere as ideas, apparently. But to be opposite is to set over against, facing, contrarily turned, moving, opposed or hostile, diametrically different, contrary, repugnant, antagonistic, so far apart as to seem irreconcilable, a setting against as to bring out their denial of each other, so that one is true and the other false, an opposition in meaning so great that each one negates or nullifies every one of the implications of the other. In her book, Ancient Art and Ritual, Jane Harrison writes, a heroic society is almost a contradiction in terms. In the old ritual dance, the individual was nothing, the choral band, the group, everything. For Harrison, a society means an enduring, cooperating social group so functioning as to maintain itself and perpetuate the species. Its first definition is of a companionship or association with one's fellows, usually centered around constructive, friendly, and intimate intercourse. In a society, patriarchy and matriarchy are not opposites, but complements for Harrison, which a society requires in order to be complete. Complements suggest a mutual relationship, and in nautical terms, complement is the entire force and personnel of a vessel, one world. Virginia Woolf wrote a short story called A Society, a comic send-up about a group of young women who are determined to find out why men have destroyed civilization, written bad books, and made weapons and war, all the while insisting that women simply ray about and reproduce. In her essay, Why, she pleads that questions be asked openly in public. Why not bring people together so that they can talk without mounting platforms or reading papers? Uh-oh. We've already violated that one rule. Would not such a society be worth, even as a form of education, all the papers on art and literature that have ever been read since the world began? These are just some other slides of Jane Harrison. This is Jane Harrison as Alcestis. This is a young Jane Harrison who was performing in Greek plays, one of the first women to do so. Actually, Janet Case was the first. Jane Harrison was second. And Janet Case is Virginia Woolf's Greek tutor. Let me see what else. And this is another picture of her, a little bit younger, in her late 20s, I believe, while she was at Newnham. In an epilogue on War, Peace with Patriotism, and Three Guineas, Jane Harrison and Virginia Woolf want to change the world. Just as Harrison revised Greek mythology, reading the Greeks through a feminist lens at the turn of the century, Virginia Woolf tries to envision a world where Antigone survives and thrives. If you look at Virginia Woolf's work, and I'll just highlight some of her major works, they're each attempts to recreate a society. Night and Day can be read as a condemnation of marriage. Jacob's Room, in Jacob's Room, the young god is killed. There is no regeneration under patriarchy, and it's even worse for men. In Mrs. Dalloway, Septimus is a war hero, but I read him as a martyr to the cause of pacifism, because he refuses to reproduce. Mrs. Dalloway also suffers under patriarchy. She says, seems to be saying, okay, I'll have one child. There, now leave me alone. No more children for wars. Into the Lighthouse, Mrs. Ramsay is not the angel in the house by any stretch of the Victorian or modern imagination. She despises her role and often her children. She wants to send them all out in the boat to drown. At nearly every turn, she seems to be saying, I truly hate patriarchy because it has only brought hardship and misery to me until the requirements under it to be good literally kill her. Jane Harrison's radical pacifism following the outbreak of World War I in Epilogue on War, Peace with Patriotism, is a position heralded and extended by Wolf in her own pacifist manifesto, Three Guineas, documenting the rise of fascism in 1938 and calling for a social recreation. It's a proclamation that echoes with Wolf's own defiant plea for peace, that as a woman I have no country, as a woman my country is the whole world. Both essays speak to each other intimately and profoundly about the nature of violence, about the individual in relation to the state, and about their mutual insistence on peacemaking themes. Both explore the sources of war, examine the function and excessive use and misuse of the concept of patriotism, and both seek out radical social alternatives founded on principles of cooperation, resistance, and communal outsidership. Epilogue on War opens with Jane Harrison's shock and disbelief that all these dons are enlisting, and she immediately experiences a violent personal reaction when rage, sheer hot rage, choked me and held me speechless. She could not believe that her colleagues, the group of male geniuses with whom she had worked and collaborated, these men whose passion it was to know the truth and teach it, these men to me, the pick of their country's manhood, would support the war when they had insisted only moments earlier that they had despised the war. Their decision to fight rocked the foundations of Harrison's world as she pleaded with them to let us grieve together, but let us not be stupid together too. Especially when the lust of conquest was maddening half of Europe, when every human value hung in the balance and all that made life worth living was threatened. War, according to Harrison, crushed values and diminished and destroyed learning, and her essay is a defiant clarification of her stance as a public intellectual. It is because, with every fiber of body and mind, I stand for peace that I want to try and understand this ancient animosity. Just as Harrison comments on the dons turned soldiers parading about in uniform, which 10 years ago would have been to him anathema, Wolf comments on the glorification and spectacle of war displayed in the uniforms, ribbons, and bows of patriarchy's heads of state. What am I showing this one? There's Jane Harrison. This is just to, break it up a little bit. This is Jane Harrison with Frances Cornford is on the right. That's who she was in love with. And they did a lot of work together. They were mutually supportive of each other's research. And that's Gilbert Murray in the middle, and Hugh Stewart is to the left. All of them Cambridge ritualists in that group of scholars. Oh, this slide probably shouldn't be in here. this is Jane Harrison with Hope Merlees, which is really a different talk. Hope Merlees was about 32 years her junior, her former student, but they had about an 11-year relationship, and they end up reading Russian and translating Russian. That long title that you heard of my earlier essay was about the two of them, their Russian translation of a little-known autobiography in Russian that Virginia Woolf published. And it's all about Russian bears and Russian folklore and things like that. And in that picture, she's holding a little toy Russian bear. Let's see. Let's get to her. This is a beautiful photograph by Man Ray of Virginia Woolf, so we'll just leave that on there as we go forward. Both Harrison and Woolf explore the qualities and instincts, psychological, biological, and social, that might help to reveal the sources of violence and war, making a connection between man's instincts and the system of education that produced him. Wolf writes that it is a fact that she cannot understand what instinct compels him, what glory, what interest, what manly satisfaction fighting provides for him. Without war, there would be no outlet for the manly qualities which fighting develops, as fighting thus is a sex characteristic which she cannot share. Her aim is social replacement and starting anew. As she asks, what is the aim of education? What kind of society, what kind of human being should it seek to produce? She will only support the charity if her correspondent satisfies her that he will use her money to produce the kind of society, the kind of people that will help you to prevent war. Women's colleges are complicit as well and tied to patriarchy. Therefore, no guinea should go to rebuilding the college on the old plan. The money instead should be earmarked, rags, petrol, matches, and she urges, take this guinea and burn the college to the ground. Set fire to the old hypocrisies, let the light of the burning building scare the nightingales and incarnadine the willows. and let the daughters of educated men dance round the fire and heap armful upon armful of dead leaves upon the flames, and let their mothers lean from the upper windows and cry, let it blaze, for we have done with this education." She concedes her position, however, because even a university for women on the old plan has to be better than sending women back to a cycle of dependency upon their fathers and brothers, because they would again be consciously and unconsciously in favor of war. An argument which she extends to women's entry into the professions, because even if one could say the professions are simply another form of slavery, they couldn't possibly be worse than the form of slavery of having to depend upon a father. Wolfe writes, "The aim of the new college, the cheap college, should be not to segregate and specialize, but to combine. I should explore the ways in which mind and body can be made to cooperate, discover what new combinations make good holes in human life." Wolfe's pacifist project is also tied to the visual evidence of war, the realities of war on the body. The packet of photos of war dead she receives weekly from the Spanish government that she describes but does not display share a tandem symbiotic relationship with the photographs of patriarchal figures she does display. The initial mention of war dead photos speaks to Wolfe's use of the violent text image to focus our eye and to make sure we see both the absent image on the page and the photographs of the patriarchs in the way she wants us to. In the initial mention of the photographs of the dead children, she points out the unrecognizability of the bodies as human. The dead children continue to haunt the text until they are ultimately blended at the end of Three Guineas with the image of man. The captionless photos and her refusal to display the photos of the dead bodies also serve her offer to her male correspondent that we see the same thing when we look at them, the horror, the evil, but they also suggest an implacable remoteness to the horrors of war that terrifies Wolfe, a fear and sense of powerlessness she shares with Jane Harrison, who discusses the same disconnection at work and any path to war. In Epilogue on War, Harrison writes, "We do not personally wage war, even the generals sit, not upon their charges leading the attack, but secluded in their bureaus. Even the men lie in their trenches, often unseen by and unseeing those other men they kill. There is horror enough, but not for us the personal horror of doing your own killing. Everything, war, commerce, politics, is nowadays huge, abstracted, remote." Like Wolfe, Harrison asks, what have we to substitute for competition? Only cooperation. Cooperation is a dull, tarnished word, tarred with the brush of utilitarian economics. But is it really a cold, dull thing, Harrison is asking, to work together to know, to work together to discover, to work together to try and make the world a better place for all of us? Can we only herd together, wolf-like, to fight? Harrison, like Wolfe, points out the dangers of competition, jealousy, and the fostering of intolerance that the university system represents, encourages, and funds. Harrison writes, "And yet our whole education, our public school system, is based on two things. Sic imponerum of the group. Dare at your peril to be different, to have personal distinction. And it's based on neck-and-neck competition in work and in games. We teach our children to work, not that they may do their best for sheer love of the thing done, but that they may do better than somebody else. Surely always an ugly thing, for someone else is hurt and minished. If children are so reared, can we wonder that grown men are at war?" Sic imponerum, okay? It translates from the German as to impose oneself. Wolfe also critiques the British education system at length and its connection to patriarchy and, by extension, fascism, as she asks, what then is this university education of which Mary Kingsley's sisterhood have heard so much and to which they have contributed so painfully? An education that works diligently and relentlessly to sink the private brother and inflate in its stead a monstrous male. Like Wolfe, Harrison examines the ways in which we validate and glorify war. She suggests that the soldier is finally vindicated when his job, the business of war, at last comes about. Invoking the rhythmic chant of a war song meant to encourage the lemming-like march of soldiers to their deaths, she writes, "When Tommy goes off to the front, he sings, I am told, we're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here." and a very good marching song it no doubt is, for Tommy's business is not psychological analysis, When the officer starts on the same errand, he has the immense personal joy, a joy perhaps beyond all others, of feeling that at least at last his profession, his particular job in life, has not only become suddenly real, but the reality of the moment, the thing that counts. Consciously or unconsciously, that thought must set his heart aflame. And Wolfe, too, suggests that because the soldier is trained by profession not to think, because if he does, he will be killed, then we must do the thinking for him, an idea she returns to in Three Guineas and elsewhere in Thoughts on Peace during an air raid, when she writes, "So let us think for him. Let us try to drag up into consciousness the subconscious Hitlerism that holds us down. It is the desire for aggression, the desire to dominate and enslave." These pictures here of Virginia Woolf were taken by Man Ray, and it's about the time that she's writing Three Guineas, which is, not writing it, but publishing it, which is 1938. It comes out in 1938. Both Harrison and Wolfe add disclaimers at the beginning of their essays that they may indeed not be qualified to speak on matters of foreign policy, given the fact that they are both women and excluded from the educational and political power so generously gifted to their male counterparts. However, they each feel qualified to speak as human beings on human nature. Harrison writes, "The only way to allay this irritation is to track out the cause and try to find the human need that call for the reaction. And if we are able to show the meaning and function of patriotism, its wrongness and its rightness, when we are truly patriotic, war will, I believe, end." Wolfe also explores the definition of patriotism and questions, but the educated man's sister, what does patriotism mean to her? Has she the same reasons for being proud of England, for loving England, for defending England? Like Wolfe, Harrison also discusses the importance of extending pacifism across all borders, as she bemoans the loss of the privileging of internationalism, the loss of the old ideals of the citizen of the world. Herd mentality and the projection of the state's needs upon the individual feed the fuel and psychology of war. War mentality instructs that before all things be local, parochial, patriotic, i.e., dwell on your differences and be prepared to fight for them. This is Harrison speaking. Cultivate the small, combative, herd emotions, and for your religion, someone outside of yourself will provide it for you. Your God must be the projection of the state and just as combative. This God, according to Harrison, demands, he necessitates immediate unquestioning faith, faith so unquestioning that it is a mainspring of action, faith wholly dogmatic and non-intellectual, whose only function is to pull the trigger. Such faith is in its final analysis a local affirmation of self-confidence. The war spirit, above all, craves for action, and only for such thinking as is immediately translatable into action. Harrison gives Dostoevsky as an example of a great writer who uncharacteristically held reactionary views tied to the Russian state that abused him. She writes, "Dostoevsky stands for patriotism, and reactionaries are all ardent patriots. Their enthusiasm is national rather than international. Dostoevsky, we have been perhaps not wholly surprised to find that the man who created these amazing figures was himself not only epileptic and dissolute, but also an arch-egotist to the verge of madness. He appears in his letters supremely a patriot in the narrowest sense. He really hated the international ideal, and yet his own country in a mock execution had Dostoevsky stood up in his shirt against the prison wall to be shot. He was then forced to live abroad, where, as Harrison writes, his utter inability to see any good in foreign lands would be childish if it were not the source of such poignant misery. Despite his treatment, Dostoevsky, the reactionary, anti-intellectualist, collectivist of the small group, this is Harrison, the nation, a patriot through and through, still loved Russia. And Harrison instructs, we have to learn from all these reactionaries and nationalists. Everyone feels love of country. Germany's love of country is now, alas, the handmaid of war. For Harrison and her intellectual colleagues and us older liberals, patriotism was not an inspiring word. It spelled narrowness, limitations. We aspired to be citizens of the world. But through Dostoevsky's example, she learned that to be patriotic, to love one's country, is not harmful. It is the idea of sic imponeren, to impose oneself, that sin's worst against patriotism. Dostoevsky, in other words, was Russia for the Russian. He never tried to impose Russianism as a gospel or a panacea, and he never even tried to infuse the Russian spirit as the salt of the earth, according to Harrison. Sikh in Panarin is the very spirit of war. True patriotism, national differentiation, is the very spirit of peace. War, which seems to be nurtured by patriotism, which seems the uttermost expression of it, turns at last on patriotism and slays it. The patriot loves his country because it is different from others, because of its local color, flavor, smell, because of its living personality. But let that country impose itself, make other countries obey its laws, accept its customs, adopt its very language, and all these distinctions, lovely and beloved, lapse into gray uniformity. Three Guineas yearns for a revisioning of society along pacifist communal lines, invoked earlier by Jane Harrison in Epilogue on War, Peace with Patriotism. When she answers her correspondents that we can best help you to prevent war, not by repeating your words and following your methods, but by finding new words and new methods. We can best help you to prevent war not by joining your society, but by remaining outside your society, but in cooperation with its aim. That aim is the same for us both. It is to assert the rights of all men and women, to the respect in their persons of the great principles of justice and equality and liberty. And it is in this spirit of a society, based not on opposition, not on the glorification of the hero, but on cooperation, that Harrison writes, we must live and let live, tolerating, nay, fostering, in the life of individuals and of nations, an infinite party-colored diversity, and so at last win peace with patriotism. Thank you.